their shirts, and a guard of four more rode behind. In the middle, on a splendid bay gelding, rode a handsome blonde lad of about 14. His white, red and gold plaid cloak was thrown back and pinned at one shoulder with an enormous ring brooch of gold, set with rubies. Beside him, on a matched bay, was an old man with a thick shock of white hair and piercing blue eyes. Madin stared briefly, then jumped up with a shout.
"Nevin! By all the gods!"
Grinning broadly, the old man turned his horse out of line and waved, paused to say something to the lad, then rode over, dismounting as Madin ran up to greet him. Madin clasped his outstretched hand and shook it hard.
"By the hells, it gladdens my heart to see you, sir."
"And mine to see you,"
Nevin said with a somewhat sly smile.
"See, I told you that our paths would cross again."
"And right you were. What are you doing in Pierden?"
"Tutoring the marked prince. Are the rest of the silver daggers with you?"
"Not far, just camped down the river. Wait, how do you know about them?"
"How do you think? Has your captain had any strange dreams lately?"
Madin turned cold with an awe that ran down his back like melting snow. Tankard in hand, a puzzled Caradoc strolled over to join them as the young prince dismounted and led his horse over to join his tutor. When Madin and Caradoc knelt to him, the prince gave them a courteous nod of acknowledgement, but the gesture was splendidly firm for one so young. Madin was instantly struck by how noble the young prince was, the gallant way he stood, the proud set to his head, the easy way his hand rested on his sword hilt, as if he'd seen many a battle beyond his years. A prince indeed, he thought, born to be king. At the thought, his cold awe grew stronger, and he wondered just why Nevin the sorcerer was here in this obscure kingdom.
"Your Highness," the old man said, "allow me to present Madin the Silver Dagger, and the captain of the troop, Caradoc of Caermore. Men, you kneel before Marin, marked prince of Pierden."
At the casual mention of his name by one he didn't know, Caradoc glared at Nevin, who ignored him with a bland smile.
"Silver daggers, are you?"
Marin said with an engaging boyish smile.
"Pierden may be at the ends of the earth, but I've heard of your troop. How many of you are there?"
90, Your Highness," Caradoc said, "and we have our own smith, chirurgeon and bard."
Marin glanced at Nevin for advice.
"It would pay to look them over, Your Highness, but you'll have to consult with your father the king first, of course."
"Well and good, then. Men, you may rise and stand in our presence."
The prince glanced Nevin's way again.
"I don't suppose I could go look them over right now."
"Not with the king expecting you back. Have the captain bring them to you on the morrow."
"Oh, very well. Captain Caradoc, assemble your troop before the gates of the royal palace on the morrow. Send me word through the guards on the causeway."
"Well and good, Your Highness. We'll arrive around noon."
With a laugh of excitement, the young prince strode back to his men. Nevin winked at Madin, then rejoined his lord. As the royal escort rode on, Caradoc stared open-mouthed until they were out of sight. He retrieved his ale from the street and led the way back to the bench, where he sat down with an exaggerated heavy sigh.
"Very well, Matho. Who is that old man?"
"The herdman who saved my life up in Cantrey. Remember me telling you about Bryn Taradic? And he's the same one who tipped Cordier off to leave Dundevery."
"A herdman for a prince's tutor? Horseshit."
"Oh, by the gods, can't you see what's been stuck under your face? The old man's Dweomer."
Caradoc choked on his ale.
"Well, he's the one who sent you the dream," Madin said after he'd recovered. "He admitted as much to me."
"Ah, well, if we get this higher, it cursed well won't be dull, will it? Dweomer men, impressive young princes, it all sounds like one of your songs."
"Oh, it's stranger than any song I know. If Nevin's come to live in Pierden, I'll wager he's got grave things afoot, and the gods only know what they are."
"Now here," Castell snapped. "When I spoke of getting you a personal guard, I was thinking of 20 men, not 90.
"But, Father, there's bound to be fighting next summer. It would be splendid if I could lead close to 100 men.
Lead? Listen, you young cub. I've told you 1,000 times that you're staying in the rear for your first campaign.
Well, if you're so worried, then the more men I have, the safer I'll be.
Cassil growled under his breath, but it was a fond exasperation.
My liege the king,
Nevin said,
if I may interject a word.
By all means.
Although I doubt the prince's motives, he does speak the truth. The larger the guard, the better. The time might well come soon when he'll need many men around him.
Cassil turned and looked at him with narrowed eyes. They were sitting in the shabby council chamber at a round table, set with only a pair of wobbly bronze candelabra.
Father?
Marin leaned across the table.
You know that Nevin's omens always come true.
It's not a matter of his prediction, but of the coin. How are we going to pay and shelter 90 mercenaries?
I've got the taxes from that bit of land in my own name. They'll help provision the troop. I get 2 whole cows this fall, just for starters.
And how long will it take hungry men to dispatch that much beef?
But, Father, you've heard all those tales about the silver daggers. Even if half of them are true, why, they fight like demons from hell.
Cassil leaned back in his chair and idly rubbed his chin with the back of his hand while he thought it over. Nevin waited silently, knowing that Marin was bound to get his own way in the end.
Well, Cassil said at last, I haven't even gotten a look at them yet. I'll review them when they arrive tomorrow, and then we'll see.
My thanks, Father. You know that the prince will always put himself under the king's orders.
Out, you little hypocrite. Go talk to your mother. She told me earlier that she wanted a word with you.
Marin made him a formal bow, nodded to Nevin, then ran out of the chamber, slamming the door behind him and breaking into a loud whistle as he trotted down the hall.
Ah, ye gods! Next summer my son rides to war. Tonight, Nevin, I feel as old as you.
No doubt, Your Highness, but I still hear a lad, not a man, when he talks of the glories of war.
Of course, but he'll learn. I only pray that our next campaign is an easy one. Here, have you had some kind of omen?
Of sorts. Your Highness, the king in Caermor is fated to die soon, I think before the winter's out.
Cassil went very still, his hands tight on the arms of the chair.
His only son is dead, Nevin went on. His 3 daughters are too young to have sons yet. Tell me, Your Highness, have you ever fancied yourself as king in Deveri? When Glyn dies, you're the heir.
Ah, by the hells, it can't be. He's just a young man.
Fevers and such like come to the young as well as the old. Your Highness had best think carefully, because with the Cantre wife he won't be terribly popular with his new vassals.
Cassil sat so still, his eyes so heavy-lidded that he seemed asleep. Nevin waited for a few minutes to let him think, before he went on.
And about the silver daggers, Your Highness? You'll need men like that if you're going to have a chance to claim the Caermor throne.
Chance? Don't be a dolt, man. Even if I had an army twice the size of the one I do, my chance is about as good as a flea's in a soap bath, and I think me you know it.
If the Caermor lords accept you, then you have a very good chance, my liege.
Cassil rose and paced to the open window, where the cold night air came in with a heavy scent of damp.
If I strip my kingdom of men to march on Caermor, Eldith will march north. It's a question of trading one kingdom for another, isn't it? Throwing away the land I have in a bid to gain land I've never seen. There are men in Caermor who have claims as good as mine. Somewhere back in my family line is a bastard son, and the other factions could easily use that against me. And while we all squabble over Caermor, the Cantre line will be taking over the rest of the kingdom. Does it sound like a fair bargain to you?
It doesn't, my liege, especially since I know a man who has a better claim to the throne of all Deveri than any other man alive.
Indeed?
Cassil turned, leaning back casually on the window frame, smiling a little in academic interest.
And who might that be?
Does His Highness truly have no idea?
Cassil froze, only his mouth working in a twist of pain.
I think me he does.
Nevin was inexorable.
Your son, my liege. While a Cantre wife would be held against you, a Cantre mother strengthens Marin's position 100-fold. He has ties to every royal line, even Eldith, strong ties.
So he does.
Cassil's voice was a whisper.
Oh, ye gods. I never gave a moment's thought to it before, truly. I never dreamt the Kaer'Mor line would fail like this. Do you think that Marin has a chance at acceptance, or will he have to fight for his throne?
I think me Kaer'Mor will welcome him. Will they want a Cantre king on the throne instead?
Of course not.
Cassil began pacing back and forth. It's going to be a hard and dangerous road to the throne, but how can I deny my son's claim to his weird?
There's more at stake than Marin's weird. This is a matter of grave import for the entire kingdom. Truly, I know that I've talked of strange omens and such like without a shred of proof, but you'll know that I've spoken the truth when news comes of Glynn's death. In the meantime, it might be politic to hire Marin as large a guard as possible.
Politic indeed, if he's the heir to 2 thrones. Done then. I'll have a look at those silver daggers on the morrow.
On the morrow morning, Marin was restless beyond a simple excitement at the chance to acquire a personal guard. When Nevin suggested that they have a talk, the prince insisted on leaving the Dun and going down to the narrow sandy beach of the island where they could be completely private. Although it was unseasonably warm still, thin cirrus clouds mackereled the sky and the leaves on the birches were a sickly yellow.
"Very well, Your Highness,"
Nevin said once they were settled in an outcrop of rock.
"What grave matter is troubling you?"
"Maybe it's naught. Maybe I'm going daft or such like."
"Indeed. Out with it."
"Well, when I met those silver daggers yesterday, I got the strangest feeling. This is the beginning," the feeling said. "You hear about men's weirds talking to them, but I never truly understood before. I do now, because I heard my weird say that to me. Or am I daft?"
"Not daft at all, truly. Your weird is gathering, sure enough."
Slack-mouthed, the prince stared out over the lake, rippling as the wind rose in a gust that shook the birches.
"Are you afraid, Your Highness?"
"Not for myself. I just thought of summat, Nevin. If I'm meant to be king, then men are going to die for me. There'll have to be a war before I can claim the throne."
"That's true."
He was silent for a long while more, looking so young, so absurdly smooth-faced and wide-eyed, that it seemed impossible that here sat the true king of Alderverey. For all that Marin had taken his training well, at 14 he was far from ready for the work ahead. But then, Nevin doubted if any man, no matter how old and wise, would ever be truly ready.
"I don't want all those deaths on my head."
He spoke abruptly, with the ring of command in his voice.
"Your Highness has no choice. If you refuse to take your weird upon you, then more men will die fighting to put some false king on your throne."
Tears welled in his eyes. He brushed them irritably away on his sleeve before he answered.
"Then I'll follow my weird."
He rose, and suddenly he looked older.
"Let no man bar me from my rightful place."
Just at noon, the message came that the silver daggers had arrived. Nevin rode out with Marin and the king to conduct something of a test of his plans. Out in the meadow at the end of the causeway, the men sat on horseback in orderly ranks with Caradoc, Mathin, and a young man that Nevin didn't recognize front and center. Behind them was a disorderly mob of pack horses, wagons, women, and even a few children.
"That's a surprise," Marin remarked. "I didn't think men like this would have wives."
"I wouldn't exactly call them wives," Cassil said. "There's still a few things you have to learn, lad."
Nevin and Marin rode behind the king as he trotted over to Caradoc. Nevin was not impressed with the troop at first sight. Although they were reasonably clean and their weapons were in good repair, they were a hard-bitten, scruffy lot, slouching in their saddles, watching the royalty with barely concealed insolence. At every man's belt, the silver hilt of the dagger gleamed like a warning. Caradoc, however, bowed low from the saddle at the king's approach.
"Greetings, Your Highness. I've brought my men as the young prince ordered. I most humbly hope Your Highness will find them acceptable." "We shall see. But if I should offer you shelter, then you'll be riding at the prince's orders, not mine."
Caradoc glanced at Marin with a slight skeptical smile, as if he were reckoning up the lad's age. In his mind, Nevin called upon the High Lords of Air and Fire, who promptly answered the prearranged signal and came to cluster around the lad. Their force enveloped him, giving him a faint glow, an aura of power. A light wind sprang up to ruffle his hair and swell his plaid, and it seemed that the very sunlight was brighter where it fell upon him. Caradoc started to speak, then bowed again, dipping as low as he could.
"I think me it would be a great honour to ride for you, my prince. Would you care to review my men?"
"I would, but let me warn you, Captain. If you take this hire, you'll be riding with me on a long road indeed. Of course, only the hard roads lead to true glory."
Caradoc bowed again, visibly shaken to hear the lad talk like the hero of a bard's tale. The silver daggers came to a stiff-backed attention in a sudden respect, and the young lieutenant beside Madin caught his breath sharply. When Nevin glanced his way, he nearly swore aloud. Geraint, with the falcon mark on shirt and sword hilt, just as it always seemed to be.
"This is Owain, good counsellor."
Caradoc noticed his interest. "Second in command in battle. Madin's our bard, and also second in command in peaceful doings."
"You seem to keep things well in hand, Captain," Marin said.
"I do my best, my prince."
Owain was looking Nevin over with more curiosity than he showed for either the prince or the king. In those hard blue eyes, Nevin saw the barest trace of recognition, a spark of their old mutual hatred that lasted only briefly before it was replaced by bewilderment. Doubtless, Owain was wondering how he could feel so strongly about an unarmed old man that he'd only just met. Nevin gave him a small smile and looked away again. He was seething with a personal excitement. Here were Geraint and Blaine, now called Owain and Madin, and there was Caradoc, who in a former life had been king himself in Caermore, under the name of Glyn the First. Glyn had been such a good king that Nevin was shocked to find him as an outcast man and a silver dagger, until he reminded himself that just such a man was essential now to the well-being of the kingdom. A mercenary like Caradoc fought for only one thing, victory. Not for him the niceties and snares of honour. He would stoop to any ruse or low trick if he had to in order to win. The members of his charmed circle of weird were all gathering for the work, and that meant that somewhere soon Bronwyn's soul would join them. Soon he would have another chance to untangle his snarl of weird. All at once, he remembered the camp followers, hovering at a respectful distance behind their men. He felt sick, wondering if she were among them. Could she have fallen so low in this life? For a moment he was honestly afraid to look, then he steeled himself. When Cassil and Caradoc began discussing the terms of the hire, Nevin left the prince in the care of the Lords of the Elements and jogged his horse along the ranks, as if the prince counsellor were having one last good look at the men his liege wished to take into his guard. Madin broke ranks to join him.
"Let's leave the horse trading to Carol and your king. By the hells, Nevin, it gladdens my heart to think we'll be spending the winter in the same dun. I know Cordia will want to talk with you too."
"Cordia?"
It took him a moment to remember the young Chirurgeon of Dundevery.
"Well now, is that young cub the Chirurgeon Caradoc spoke of? I take it he followed my advice all those years ago."
"So he did, and I'll wager it saved his life when Slimar died too."
"Good. It seems he took my advice about abortions as well, judging from the pack of children I see over there. How many lasses have you picked up along the road, Matho? I seem to remember that you've always had luck with women."
"Oh, these are hardly all mine. We share what we can get when we can, you see."
Nevin did see, entirely too well. The thought of Bronwyn living past from man to man was like a bitter taste of poison in his mouth. Most of the women were riding astride, their skirts hitched up around them, some with a small child behind them, but all of them, mothers or not, were as hard-eyed and suspicious as their men. At the very rear, a pale blonde woman was sitting in a mule cart, cushioned by blankets as she nursed a baby.
"That's Cluna," Madin said, gesturing at her. "When we're back at the dun, I'd be ever so grateful if you or some other herbman would have a look at her. She hasn't been well since the babe was born, and Cordia can't seem to mend her. She's as much my woman as any of them are."
"Oh, let's talk to her right now."
Nevin's heart sank with dread.
The king and your captain will doubtless be a while yet.
When they rode over, Clinna glanced up indifferently. There were dark circles like bruises under her blue eyes, and her skin was far too pale. Nevin almost gasped in relief when he realized that she was not his Bronwyn at all.
"This is Nevin, the best herdman in the kingdom," Madden said with forced cheer. "He'll have you right as rain straight away, my sweet."
Clinna merely smiled as if she doubted it.
"Well, it's a simple enough diagnosis, truly," Nevin said. "A good midwife would have spotted it in a minute, but the only women courtiers ever tended were rich and well-fed. Here, lass, your blood is weak because you just birthed a babe, and I'll wager you haven't been eating right. Get an apple, put an iron nail in it, and leave it there overnight. Then take it out and eat the apple. You'll see the red streak of the sanguine humour, which is what you need. Do that every night for a fortnight, and then we'll see."
"My thanks," Clinna was stammering in surprise. "It's good of a courtly man like you to give advice to a silver dagger's wench."
"Oh, I'm not as courtly as I seem. Here, your babe is a pretty little thing. Who's the father?"
"And how would I know, my lord?"
She shrugged in sincere indifference.
"Mathins or Athens, most like, but she could be the captain's, too."
In return for their winter's keep and a silver piece a man if they should see any fighting, Caradoc pledged his loyalty to Prince Marin through the spring, with terms to be renegotiated at Beltane. Getting so large a troop quartered in the cramped island Dun was something of a problem. The Chamberlain and the captain of Castle's warband conferred for an hour, then sent servants running all over the ward until at last the mercenaries had a barracks of their own, a stable for their horses, and a shed for their wagons and extra gear. The Chamberlain was an old man with an amazing mind for details and a scrupulous sense of propriety. He was quite outraged, he told Nevin, to find that the Silver Daggers found nothing wrong with keeping the women right in the same barracks with them.
"Well, why not?" Nevin said. "It'll keep the lasses safe from the king's riders. Or do you want fights all winter long?"
"But what of those innocent children?"
"Let us profoundly hope that they're sound sleepers."
After the evening meal, Nevin went out to visit Madden in the barracks. When he came into the long room, dimly lit by firelight, he had to pause for a moment and catch his breath at the combined reek of horse, man-sweat and smoke. Most of the men were playing dice. The women huddled at the far end to gossip among themselves while the babies slept nearby. At the hearth, Madden, Caradoc and Cordia sat on the floor and talked, while Owen lay nearby, stretched out on his stomach with his head pillowed on his arms. Although he seemed asleep, he looked up briefly when Madden introduced him to Nevin, then went back to watching the fire.
"Come sit down," Cordia said, sliding over a bit to make room. "It gladdens my heart to see you again. I thought that a sorcerer like you would have more important work at hand than selling herbs." "Oh, the herbs are important in their own way too, lad. Now tell me, how did you end up with that silver dagger in your belt?"
For a long while, Cordia, Madden and Nevin talked of old times, while Caradoc listened with close attention and Owain fell asleep. At length, the talk turned inevitably to Nevin's strange employment in the king's palace. Nevin put them off with vague questions until Caradoc joined in.
"Here, good sorcerer, what's the Dwayolmer doing hiring a piss-poor bunch of men like us? I think me we've got a right to know, since you're asking us to die for the prince as like as not."
"Now here, captain, I'm not asking a thing of you. The prince is the one who gives you meat and mead."
"Oh, shit. The prince does what you tell him, at least when summat important's at stake."
He exchanged a glance with Madden.
"I was impressed with the lad. Very impressed, you might say."
"Indeed?"
When Caradoc hesitated, Madden leaned forward.
"You've found the true king, haven't you? Admit it, Nevin. That lad has to be the true king, or no one on earth ever will be."
Although he wanted to whoop and dance in triumph, Nevin restrained himself to a small cryptic smile.
"Tell me, captain," he said casually. "How would you feel about leading your men all the way to Dundevery some day?"
Caradoc pulled his silver dagger and held it point up to catch the wink and glint of firelight.
"This is the only honour any of us have left, and I'll swear you an oath on it. Either I see the king on his throne, or I die over the prince's body."
And you're willing to die for a man you saw for the first time today?
Why not? Better than dying for some little pussboil of an arrogant minor lord.
With a laugh, he sheathed the dagger. And when does the war begin?
Soon, Captain. Very soon.
Smiling to himself, Caradoc nodded. Nevin felt like weeping. He could see in the captain's berserker eyes the bloody price they would all pay for victory. Since everyone in Eldith knew about the silver daggers, the news that they'd left for Pierden spread fast. It was just his luck, Branowick decided, that they'd move on just when he needed to find them. Even though a single rider could travel faster than a troop with a baggage train, they had a head start of some 10 nights, and he never caught them on the road. After one last cold night of sleeping outside because he couldn't afford an inn, he rode into Drillock around noon and found a cheap tavern where he spent his last 2 coppers on a tankard of ale and a chunk of bread. He ate standing up with his back to the wall while he kept an eye on the other patrons, who were a scruffy lot to his way of thinking. As soon as the trade would allow, the serving lass minced over to him with a suggestive little smile. Unwashed and skinny, she appealed to him about as much as the flea-bitten hounds by the hearth, but he decided that he might as well get some information out of her.
How far is it to Kingcastle's Don, lass?
About 2 miles on the west running road. You must be from a long way away if you don't know that.
I am, truly. Now tell me, has a troop of mercenaries been through here? They hail from Eldith, the lads I want, and they all carry daggers with silver pommels.
Oh, they were, sure enough, and a nasty lot they looked. I don't know why the king took them on.
Because they're some of the best fighting men in the 3 kingdoms, no doubt.
He strode away before she could flirt with him further. Out in the tavern yard, his chestnut gelding stood waiting, laden with everything he owned in the world. A bedroll, a pair of mostly empty saddlebags, and a shield, nicked and battered under its coat of dirty whitewash. He hoped that Caradoc wouldn't hold his lack of mail against him, but he had a good sword at least, and he knew how to use it. When Branowick rode up the causeway leading to Castle's Dun, the guards refused to let him pass, and no more would they take in a message for a dirty and dangerous-looking stranger. Since he had no money for a bribe, Branowick tried first courtesy, then arguing, but neither worked. The guards only laughed and told him that if he wanted to see Caradoc, he'd have to camp there until the captain rode out. By then, Branowick was so furious that he was tempted to draw his sword and force the issue, but common sense prevailed. He hadn't ridden all the way from Eldith only to get himself hanged by some petty king.
"Well and good, then," he said. "I'll sit at your gates and starve until you're shamed enough to let me in."
As he strode away, leading his horse, he glanced back to see the guards looking apprehensive, as if they believed him capable of it. In truth, since he had neither coin nor food, he had little choice in the matter. In the meadow across the road, he slacked the chestnut's bit and let it graze, then sat down where he could glare at the guards and be easily seen. As the morning crept by, they kept giving him nervous looks that might have been inspired by guilt, but of course they may have been merely afraid of his temper. Although he was only 20, Branowick was 6'4", broad in the shoulders, with the long arms of a born swordsman and a warrior's stance. Down his left cheek was a thick, puckered scar, a souvenir of the death duel that had gotten him exiled from his father's dun in Belglaith. Better men than Castle's guards had found him nerve-wracking before. He'd been waiting by the road about 2 hours when he heard the blare of silver horns. As the farther gates opened, the guards by the road snapped to smart attention. Walking their horses down the causeway rode the silver daggers, sitting with the easy arrogant slump in their saddles that he remembered. At their head was a lad of about 14, with a red, gold and white plaid slung from his shoulder. When Branowick started forward, one of the guards yelled at him.
"You! Get back! That's the Mark Prince Marin, and don't you go bothering the captain when he's riding with him!"
Although it griped his soul, Branowick retreated without arguing. The affairs of a prince were bound to take precedence over those of a commoner. He was just about to sit back down when he heard himself being hailed, but this time by the prince himself. He hurried back over and clasped the lad's stirrup as a sign of humility.
"Any man who asks has access to me."
Marin shot a pointed glance at the guards.
"A prince is the shepherd of his people, not one of the wolves. Remember that from now on."
He turned back to Branowick with a distant but gracious smile.
"Now,
What matter do you have to lay before me?
My humble thanks, Your Highness.
Branwick was practically stammering in amazement.
But truly, all I wanted was a word with Caradoc.
Well, that's an easily granted boon. Get your horse and ride with us a ways.
Branwick ran to follow his order. When he fell into line beside Caradoc, the captain gave him an oddly sly smile.
Branwick of Belgrace, is it? What are you doing on the long road north? Looking for you. Do you remember when last we met? You told me you'd take me on if I wanted to ride with you. Was that just a jest?
It was a jest only because I didn't think you'd want to leave your noble father's court, not because I wouldn't be glad to have you in my troop.
Thanks be to the gods, then. A bastard's son got a shorter welcome than a silver dagger unless he minds every courtesy. I've been exiled. It was over an honour duel.
Caradoc's eyebrows shot up.
I heard about that. You killed the youngest son of the Guerbret of Elrith, wasn't it? But why would your father turn you out over that? I heard it was a fair fight.
It was, and judged so by a priest of Bel, too.
For a moment, Branwick had trouble speaking. He felt as if he could physically choke on the injustice.
But it made my father a powerful enemy, and so he kicked me out to appease the misbegotten Guerbret. The whole way north I was afraid for my life, thinking that Elrith would have me murdered on the road. But either I thought ill of him unjustly, or else I gave his men the slip.
I'd say the latter from what I remember of his grace. Well and good, lad. You're on. But you have to earn this dagger. If we see fighting, you'll get a full share of the pay, mind. But you'll have to prove yourself before I have Otho the Smith make you a blade. Agreed?
Agreed. And my thanks. There's not a soul in the world to take me in but you.
For a few minutes they rode in silence. Branwick studied the young prince riding some few yards ahead, and wondered what it was that made him seem so unusual. He was a handsome boy, but there were plenty of good-looking men in the kingdom, and none of them had his aura of glamour and power. There were other princes, too, who had his straight-backed self-confidence and gracious ways, but none that seemed to have ridden straight out of an old epic, like Marin. At times it seemed as if the very air around him crackled and snapped with some unseen force.
And what do you think of our lord?
Caradoc said quietly.
Well, he makes me remember some old gossip I heard down in Eldis.
Gossip?
Well, omens and such like.
Omens of what?
In a fit of embarrassment, Branwick merely shrugged.
Out with it, lad.
Well, about the one true king of Deveri.
Caradoc laughed under his breath.
If you stick with this troop, lad, you'll be leaving Eldith and Pierden far behind. Can you stomach that?
Easily. Oh, here, what are you telling me? Will we be riding all the way to Dundevery some fine day?
We will at that, but I can promise you a long bloody road to the Holy City.
Caradoc turned in his saddle.
Madin, get up here. We've got a new recruit.
Somehow or other, Branwick had missed meeting the bard in his previous encounters with the Silver Daggers. About 33, he was a slender but hard-muscled man with a mop of curly blonde hair, streaked with grey at the temples, and world-weary blue eyes. Branwick liked him from the moment he met him. He felt in some odd way that they must have known each other before, even though he couldn't remember when or how. All that afternoon, Madin introduced him around, explained the rules of the troops, found him a stall for his horse and a bunk when they returned to the dun, and generally went out of his way to make him feel at ease. At the evening meal they sat together, and Branwick found it easy to let the bard do most of the talking. The other lieutenant in the troop, Owain, was a different matter altogether. They had barely finished eating when he strode over, his tankard in hand, and Branwick found himself hating him. There was just something about the way that the arrogant son of a bitch stood, he decided, all posturing with his head tossed back, his free hand on the hilt of his silver dagger.
You, Owain snapped. I see by your blazon that you used to ride for the Eagle Clan of Belgrace.
I did. What's it to you?
Not, except for one small thing.
Owain paused for an insolent sip of ale.
You've got the clan device all over your gear. I want it taken off.
What?
You heard me.
Owain touched the yoke of his shirt, which sported an embroidered falcon.
Those eagles look too much like my device. I want them gone.
Oh, do you now?
Slowly and carefully, Branowick swung free of the bench and stood up to face him. Dimly he was aware that the hall had fallen silent.
"I was born into that clan, you piss-proud little mongrel. I've got every right to wear that device if I want, and want it I do."
Like Dwayoma, Caradoc materialized in between them and laid a restraining hand on Branowick's sword arm.
"Listen, Owain," the captain said. "The lad's gear will get lost or broken soon enough, and the eagles fly away of their own accord."
"That's not soon enough. I won't have fighting in our prince's hall."
"Then let's go out in the ward," Branowick broke in. "Let's settle it, Owain, with a fist fight between the two of us, and the winner gets the device."
"For a new man, you're an insolent little bastard."
Then Owain caught the grim look on Caradoc's face.
"Oh, very well then, you're on."
Nearly everyone in the great hall trooped after them to watch when they went out. While a couple of pages ran off for torches, the combatants took off their sword belts and handed them to Mavin. Wagers went back and forth between the onlookers. When the torches arrived, Branowick and Owain faced off and began circling, sizing each other up. Since Branowick had won every fist fight he'd ever fought, he was confident, too confident. He plunged straight in, swung, and felt Owain block his punch at the same moment that a fist jammed into his stomach. Gasping, he dodged back, but Owain was right there, dancing in from the side, clipping him on the side of the jaw. Although the blow stung more than hurt, Branowick went into a berserker rage, swinging back, closing, punching, feeling nothing but a swelling dizziness as Owain blocked and danced and hit in return.
"Enough!"
Caradoc's voice sliced through the red haze surrounding him.
"I said, hold and stand by the Lord of Hell's balls."
Arms grabbed him and pulled him back. With a gasp for breath, Branowick tossed his head and saw blood scatter from a cut over his left eye. Owain was standing in front of him, his nose running blood. He smiled as Branowick took a step back and felt his knees buckle under him. When the men holding him lowered him gently to the cobbles, all he could do was sit there, gasping for breath, feeling his face and stomach throb with pain and the blood run down his cheek.
"This had better end it," Caradoc said. "Owain gets the little chicken since he's so fond of them, but I don't want anyone mocking Branowick for this either. Hear me?"
There were mutters of agreement from the other silver daggers. In a flood of good-natured laughter, the crowd broke up, settling wagers as they drifted back to the great hall. Branowick stayed outside. He felt so humiliated that he was sure he could never look another man in the face again. Mavin caught his arm and helped him stand.
"Now look, lad. I've never seen a man before who could give Owain a bloody nose. You don't need to lie to spare my feelings." "I'm not. If you can keep Owain from knocking you out cold on the cobbles, then you've won a victory of sorts."
It was so sincerely said that Branowick felt his shame lift. Stumbling and staggering, he had to lean on Mavin as they headed for the barracks. About halfway there, they were stopped by the old man, whom Mavin had pointed out earlier as the prince's counsellor. Nevin held up the lantern he was carrying and peered into Branowick's bleeding face.
"I'll tell Cordia to get out to the barracks. This lad needs a couple of stitches in that cut over his eye. Make sure you get him to lie down, Matho."
"Oh, I'll wager he won't be wanting to dance the night away."
Although Branowick tried to smile at the jest, his mouth hurt too badly. Suddenly, Nevin looked straight into his eyes, and the gaze caught him like a spear, impaling deep into his soul. In his muddled state, he felt as if he'd been trying to find this man all his life for some reason that he should remember, that he absolutely had to remember. Then the insight vanished in a flood of nausea.
"He's going to heave," Nevin said calmly. "That's all right, lad. Get it all out."
Branowick dropped to his knees and vomited, his stomach burning from Owain's fist. Never in his life had he felt so humiliated that Nevin would see him like this. But when he was finally done and looked up to apologize, the old man was gone. Nevin returned to his chamber, lit the ready-laid fire with a wave of his hand, and sat down in a comfortable chair to think about this blonde, young Eldith man that Caradoc had brought in from the road like a stray dog. Nevin had recognized him the moment he'd seen him. Or rather, he knew perfectly well that he should recognize the soul looking out through those cornflower blue eyes. Unfortunately, he couldn't quite remember who he'd been in former lives. While Mathin felt well disposed to the lad, Owain had hated him on sight, a mutual feeling, it seemed. Logically, then, in his last life, Branwick might have been a loyal member of Guinevere's warband, still bearing his old grudge against the man who had tried to rape a holy priestess. Since Nevin had never paid any particular attention to the warband, it was also logical that he wouldn't remember all its members. On the other hand, he'd felt such a strong Dwayoma touch at the sight of the lad that surely he had to be someone more important than one of Gwyn and Rickon's riders.
"Maybe her brother-in-law," he said aloud. "What was his name, anyway? Ye gods, I can't remember that either. I must be getting old."
Over the next few days, his mind at odd moments worried over the problem of Branwick's identity, like a terrier in front of a rat cage. It growled and snapped, but couldn't get the rat out. He did decide, however, that the lad's arrival was an omen of sorts, a true one, rather than another faked and theatrical glamour such as those that he and the priests were spreading about the coming of the king. One or two at a time, many had trusted in lives past were coming to help him bring peace to the kingdom. Soon enough, he had news of an ominous kind to occupy his attention. Some weeks past, he had sent to the Temple of Bel at Hendir for copies of two important works on Dveri common law, and when the messenger returned, he also brought a letter from Danir, the high priest down in Caermore, a letter that was sealed twice and written in the ancient tongue of the homeland that few could read.
"King Glynn has fallen ill," Danir wrote. "Everyone whispers of poison, although such seems doubtful to me. The king's chirurgeons have diagnosed a congestion of the liver, and truly it is no secret that the king has indulged himself with mead in unseemly quantities ever since he was old enough to drink. Yet I thought it wise to inform you of these rumours nonetheless, for we cannot have it said that the true king poisoned one of his rivals. Any counsel you might send would be appreciated. But for the love of every god, write only in the ancient tongue."
When he finished, Nevin swore aloud with vile oaths in both the ancient and the modern tongues. Danir was exactly right. No one would believe Marin the true king if they thought he'd used poison to gain a throne. All the blame, if indeed blame there were, had to be cast onto the other claimant up in Dundevery, or rather onto the various minions of the Boar clan that surrounded the 18-year-old king. At that point, Nevin remembered Cordia, and he thanked the Lords of Light with all his soul for giving him the weapons he needed to win this battle. The Chirurgeon's evidence about the circumstances surrounding the death of the last king would no doubt throw any suspicion firmly where it belonged. Smiling grimly to himself, Nevin went to his writing desk and drafted a letter to Danir straight away. Yet when he was done, and the letter safely sealed against the off chance that there was someone around who could read it, he sat at his desk for a long time and considered this matter of poison. Even though it seemed that Glynn was dying of self-induced natural causes, there was no doubt that poison had become available in the Torn Kingdoms. Who was brewing it? What if there were followers of the Dark Dwayoma around, waiting their chance to plunge the country deeper into chaos? And did they know about Marin? He went cold all over, cursing himself for a fool, for a proud, stupid dolt to think he could keep such a crucial secret from those who made it their business to ferret out secrets. He would have to see if his suspicions were correct, and if they were, mere scrying through a fire would be useless. He barred the door to his chamber, then lay down on his bed, lying on his back with his arms crossed over his chest. First he calmed his breathing, then summoned the body of light, seeing the glowing man-shape first in his mind, then pouring his will into it until it seemed to stand beside him in the chamber. He transferred his consciousness over, heard a rushy click, and floated in the air, looking down at his inert body. Slipping out a window, he flew up high until he could look down on the dun, a black dead lump in the throbbing silver mist of elemental force arising from the lake. Although the mist made it difficult for him to hold his place, he was forced to fight against some truly dangerous currents. Still, he was glad to see it, because its presence would make scrying into the dun difficult indeed. The lake had turned the dun into a safe fortress on more plains than one. Navigating carefully, Nevin got clear of the lake's aura and flew over the sleeping countryside, a dull red-brown now that autumn was sapping the energies of the plant life. In their true forms, beautiful, ever-changing crystalline structures of coloured light, the wild folk swarmed around and accompanied him on his flight. About 5 miles from the dun, he had his first warning of evil, when the spirits paused, shuddering, then disappeared in silver flashes and long winkings out of light. He stopped and waited, hovering above a patch of woodland to take in perfect shelter in its ebbing glow. None of the wild folk returned. Whatever had frightened them had done so badly. He flew up higher until the blue light was as thick as fog, ever swirling and drifting, hiding the landscape below. When he visualized light flowing from his fingertips, light appeared, the volatile mind stuff responding instantly to the form he imposed upon it. With glowing lines of light, he drew an enormous sigil of protection in front of him. Since it would be visible for a great distance, it was the perfect bait to draw the attention of any other travellers on the etheric that night. For a long while he waited there like a hunter near a snare, until at last he saw another human-shaped body of light far off from him in the blue mists. He drew another sigil, this one of greeting and friendship, and was rewarded by seeing his fellow traveller first go stock still, then turn and flee at top speed. Instinctively, Nevin started after, only to stop himself before he'd gone far. He had no idea of how strong the enemy was, or even if he were alone. He was certain, however, that an enemy it was. Any servant of the light would have answered that sigil with a similar one, and then come to meet him. Rather than risk some foolhardy battle, Nevin returned to the dun and his physical body. Stretching, he sat up on the bed and looked into the fire on the hearth.
"Bad news! I think me that someone's spying on us!"
In alarm, the spirits of fire flared up, sending a shower of sparks up the chimney.
"If you see anything the least bit unusual, tell me."
Within the flames, the gleaming salamanders nodded their agreement. Nevin got up, took his heavy cloak and left the chamber. He went up the spiral staircase to the last landing of the broch, where a trapdoor gave access to the roof. After a quick glance round to make sure that no servants were there to see this eccentric behaviour on the part of the learned counsellor, he pried it up and climbed out onto the roof. He had a strange sort of guard to post. First, he raised his arms high and called upon the power of the holy light that stands behind all the gods. Its visible symbol came to him in a glowing spear that pierced him from head to foot. For a moment he stood motionless, paying it homage, then stretched his arms out shoulder high, bringing the light with them to form a shaft across his chest. As he stood within the cross, the light swelled, strengthening him, then slowly faded of its own will. When it was gone, he lowered his arms, then visualized a sword of glowing light in his right hand. Once the image lived apart from his will, he circled the roof, walking jostle, and used the sword to draw a huge ring of golden light in the sky. As the ring settled to earth, it sheeted out, forming a burning wall around the entire dun. 3 times around he went, until the wall lived on the etheric of its own will. At each ordinal point, he put a seal in the shape of a 5-pointed star made of blue fire. Once the 4 directions were sealed, he spread the light until it was not a ring, but a hemisphere over the dun like a canopy. He made 2 last seals at zenith and nadir, then withdrew the force from the astral sword until it vanished. To signify the end of the working, he stamped 3 times on the roof. The dome, however, remained visible, that is, visible to someone with Dwayoma's sight. Although he would have to renew the seals 5 times a day whenever the astral tides changed, everyone within the dome would be safe from evil prying eyes. Wrapping his cloak tightly around him, for the air nipped with the promise of winter, he went to the wall and idly looked down into the ward. Someone was walking there, and the way he moved was suspicious, taking a few steps, pausing to look carefully round, then walking slowly on again. With his mind full of thoughts of spies, Nevin left the roof and rushed down the inside staircase so fast that he nearly ended his physical existence there and then. When he ran out into the ward, the mysterious figure was no longer in sight. Muttering under his breath, he summoned wild folk, among them a large mottled gnome who had indeed seen the prowler. The gnome led him straight around the main broch and towards the stables, with absolutely no sign of fear, which made Nevin think he'd been overly dramatic to assume that the dark Dwayoma had a spy right in the dun. Sure enough, when he saw his quarry, he realized it was Branowick. Even in the dark, the lad's sheer size and the straight-backed way he stood were recognisable.
"Good eve, lad. Taking the air?"
"In a way, Counsellor. I thought I saw a fire."
"Ye gods, where?"
"Well, I was wrong about it, you see."
The lad sounded profoundly embarrassed.
"I'm cursed glad now that I didn't go waking everyone up. I must have just been having a bad dream."
"Indeed. Tell me about it."
"Well, since I'm the new man, I got the bunk right by the draughty window in our barracks. I dreamt I was awake and looking out, and the dun walls were blazing with fire. So I started to shout the alarm, but then I remembered that this dun has stone walls, not a wooden palisade or such like. Right then I must have woken up. But I lay there thinking about it, and it nagged at me. So I grabbed my boots and came to look around. And as soon as I did, I realized that it had to be a dream, but it was a demon-sent vivid one, good sir."
Nevin was taken completely aback. Obviously, this young lout of a warrior had a touch of the Dwayoma, and in his dream state had seen Nevin sealing the walls. Yet none of the men in the charm circle of his weird had ever shown such talents.
"By the hells," he thought, and irritably, "just who is he? Tell me, do you often have dreams like that?"
"Well, sometimes. I mean, I've never dreamt about fires before, but at times I have these dreams that seem so real I'd swear I was wide awake. Every now and then..."
He let his voice trail away.
"Every now and again you dream summat that turns out to be true."
With a gulp of breath, Branowick stepped sharply back.
"If my lordship will excuse me," he stammered, "I'd best be gone. It's freezing out here."
He turned and frankly ran from the man who discovered his secret.
"Young dolt," Nevin thought, but with some affection.
He would have to talk some more with Branowick, no matter who he... And then he saw it, what had been right under his nose, but so unwelcome that he'd kept it at bay for days.
"It can't be. The Lords of Weird wouldn't do this to me, would they?"
And yet he was remembering his Bronwyn's last incarnation, when as Guinevere she'd dreamt of becoming the best warrior in all Deveri. In this life, the Lords of Weird had given her a body fit to fulfil that dream, and then, or so he hoped, finally put it to rest. While every soul is at root of one polarity, which translates into the sex of the physical body, each spends part of its lifetimes in bodies of the opposite sex in order to have a full experience of the worlds of form. Nevin had simply been refusing to see that such a time had come for Bronwyn, his lovely, delicate little Gwenny, as he still thought of her. For all he knew, she was working out part of her weird that had nothing to do with him personally. Whatever the reason, she'd returned to him just as he'd known she would, but as Branowick of Belglaith. As he paced back and forth in the dark, silent ward, Nevin was sick with weariness. He could see a dark message for himself in her soul's choice of a body. Deep in his heart, he'd been hoping that she would love him again, that they would have a warm, human relationship, not merely the cold discipline of apprentice and master. Apparently such a love was forbidden. He saw Branowick as a warning, that he was to teach the Dwayoma to the inner soul and forget about the outer form and its emotions. As much as it ached his heart, he would accept the will of the Great Ones, just as he had accepted so much else in the long years since he'd sworn his rash vow. And after all, he had work on hand so important that his own feelings, even his own weird, seemed utterly insignificant. Thinking about the battle ahead, he could lay aside his personal griefs and feel hope kindling in his heart. Danger lay ahead, and great griefs, but afterward the light would prevail again in the shattered kingdom. On the morrow, a cool but sunny day, Mathin went for a stroll round the edge of the lake. He found a warm spot in the shelter of a leafless willow tree and sat down to tune his harp. It had never been an expensive instrument, and now it was battered and nicked from its long years of riding behind his saddle, yet it had the sweetest tone of any harp in the kingdom. Although many a bard in many a great lord's hall had offered him gold for it, he would rather have parted with a leg, and although those same bards had begged him to tell them his secret, he never had. After all, would they have believed him if he'd told the truth, that the wild folk had enchanted it for him? He often saw them touching it, stroking it all over like a beloved cat, and every time they did, it sang with a renewed, heart-aching sweetness. As he tuned the strings that day by the lake, the wild folk came to listen, appearing out of the air, rising out of the water, sylph and sprite and gnome, clustering round the man that they considered their own personal bard.
"I think it's time I made up a song about Prince Marin. I take it you think he's the true king too. I've seen you riding on his saddle and clustering round him in the hall."
They all nodded, turning as solemn as he'd ever seen them, until an Undine could stand the quiet no longer. Dripping with illusionary water, she reached over and pinched a green gnome as hard as she could. He slapped her, and they tussled, kicking and biting, until Mathen yelled at them to stop. All sulks, they sat down again, as far apart from each other as they could.
"That's better. Maybe I'll sing about Dilly Blind first, shall I?"
With little nods and grins, they crowded close. Over the years, Mathen had elaborated the simple folk songs about Dilly Blind and the wild folk into something of an epic, adding verse after verse and clarifying the various stories. He had taught his mock saga to bards in Dun, where there were noble children, until half of Eldith knew the song. At moments like these, when the wars seemed far away, it amused him to think that a children's song would outlive him, passed down from bard to bard when he was long since in his warrior's grave. When the song was done, and it was a good 20 minutes long, most of the wild folk slipped away, but a few lingered, his blue sprite among them, sitting close behind him as he watched the ripples in the lake, the harp silent in his hands. He remembered that other lake up in Cantray, 10 years or so ago now, that had tormented his thirst as he rode dying. It had been about the same time of day, he decided, because the sun had rippled it with gold flecks just as it was doing to Drillock in front of him. He could see in his mind the dark reeds and the white heron, and he could feel, too, the burning thirst and the pain, the sickening buzz of the flies and his dark despair.
"It was worth it," he remarked to the sprite. "It brought me to Nevin, after all."
She nodded and patted him gently on the knee. Mathen smiled, thinking of what lay ahead. There was not the least doubt in his mind that Nevin had found the man born to be king of all Deveri. He believed with his heart and soul that the young prince had been handpicked by the gods to reunite the kingdom. Soon he and the other Silver Daggers would ride behind Marin when he set out to claim his birthright. The only thing Mathen wondered about was when the time would come. As the sunlight faded from the lake and the night wind began to pick up, it seemed to him that his entire life had led to this point, when he, Caradoc, Owain, and all the rest of the men in his troop were poised and ready, like arrows nocked in the bows of a line of archers. Soon would come the order to draw and loose. Soon, he told himself, truly, soon enough. He jumped to his feet and called out, a peal of his berserk laughter ringing across the lake toward the sunset. The strings of his harp sounded softly in answer, trembling in the wind. Grinning to himself, he slung the harp over his shoulder and started back to the dun, glowing with warm firelight and torchlight in the gathering night. Part 2. Summer, 1064. The Lords of Weird do not make a man's life as neatly as a master potter turns out bowls, each perfectly shaped and suitable to its purpose. In the ebb and flow of birth and death are strange currents, eddies and vortices, most of which are beyond the power of the Great Ones to control. The Secret Book of Cadwallon the Druid. 1. The sound of rain drumming on the ward outside echoed pleasantly in the Great Hall. In her chair by the fire, Aunt Gwerna was drowsing over her needlework. Occasionally she would look up and answer a dutiful, true-spoken, to one of her husband's rhetorical questions. Perrin's uncle, Benwick, Tyron Prencluden, was in one of his expostulatory moods. He sat straight in his chair, one heavy hand gripping a tankard, the other emphasizing his points by slamming the chair arm. Benwick was going quite heavily grey, but he was still as strong-muscled as many a younger man, and as strong in the lungs, too.
"It's these worm-riddled pikemen," he bellowed. "Battle's not the same with common-born men fighting in it. They shall be guarding the carts and naught else. Cursed near blasphemous, if you ask me."
"True spoken," Perrin said dutifully.
Ha! More of this wretched courtly mincing around, that's all it is. Trust the blasted southerners to come up with summat like this. It's no wonder the kingdom's not what it was.
While Benwick soothed his feelings with a long swallow of ale, Perrin tried to unravel the connection between spearing a man off his horse and the fine manners of the king's court.
You young lads nowadays,
his uncle went on.
Now, if you'd only ridden in some of the battles I did at your age, then you'd understand what life here in